So it gives me a lot of pleasure to introduce Habiba Baberoun, whom I've known, I think, since you came. I'm trying to remember. But it's an honor to know her because I love her work, and I'm really excited to hear what you have to say in this context as well. Many of you are here for our class. The Palmer Museum has arranged for a series of gallery talks or conversations to go along with the Judy Chicago exhibition. And what we did is we invited feminist scholars from several different disciplines to kind of talk about Judy's work or respond to Judy's work. I don't know, maybe I should call it Chicago. We're not on a first name basis necessarily. But to respond to her work, and Habiba is the last conversation that we'll be featuring at the museum, and it's been a wonderful experience hearing everybody talk about her work from these disciplinary perspectives and these feminist perspectives. Habiba is an assistant professor of women's studies and African and African American studies at Penn State. She's the author of the poetry collections The Dream in the Next Body, The Museum of Ordinary Life, and 100 Silences. And I know Habiba mostly as a poet, so I'm really excited to see all of these publications. The Dream in the Next Body was named a notable book of 2005 by the Sunday Independent in South Africa and was a Sunday Times recommended book. She received a Dalmer Chrysler Award for South African poetry and held the guest writer fellowship at the Nordic Africa Institute, the second person after Ama Ato Adu. Did I get that right? Okay. To receive this honor. In 2008, she was the recipient of a Civitella Ranieri Fellowship in Italy and a writer's residency at the University of Witwatersrand. Okay. Habiba has read at international literary festivals. Oh my gosh, a lot of them. Your fiction appears in Chimarenga, Twist, Cape Town Calling. She is also a scholar and writes for the media. Details of her academic writing and her articles, of course, are also on habiba.com. So without any further introduction, please help me in welcoming Habiba Baberoun.
Thank you very much, and please give me an indication if my voice is too soft. And I do not own such a magnificent thing. This is Dana's iPad, in which has loaded some images, which I hope will be of use as we think through and I describe some of the works that I'll be discussing today. Thank you very much to the Palmer Museum and to Karen Kiefer Boyd and your class, as well as the broader audience who loves and is challenged by art, among which I count myself. Of course, thank you very much to Judy Chicago, the icon of feminist art, and the occasion in which to think through exactly what art is, what is the relationship of feminism to art, and what one can say in response to the gift of this archive to Penn State. I called my presentation The Conversation Around the Table, Transnational Feminist Art, because, of course, one knows that the collaborative impulse and the collaborative method was profoundly present in the work within a party. One knows that it generated a series of conversations that have ranged from deeply welcoming and hospitable, as one might find apt in relation to something called a dinner party, to hostile, anxious, and characterized by sustained misunderstanding. So I call it then a conversation around the table because I want to accept the implicit hospitality of an artwork that says the dinner party. And I also want to think about what it means to be in a university which is now housing a gift from an artist, has been hospitable to a gift from an artist. And what does it mean to be an artist oneself and also to be a critic of art in response to a generous gift, right? So I think it's important to then create the basis of a conversation that is hospitable and critical at the same time. And so I want to take up the question of who's at the table, how we speak around that table, who's not at the table, who's under the table, and what conversations around the idea of food and of inclusion and of exclusion might take place. Most of the pieces I want to speak about today take up this idea of collaborative and hospitable method of themes, and of the critical space that art generates and is part of and enables, right? So the feminist art and the transnational feminist art that I'm most intimate with, the word intimacy is another very apt one for this work, is feminist art from South Africa. And feminist art from South Africa is a very erudite work. It is a work that is national and by definition transnational, because as some of you were already gesturing in your earlier answers to the question of what are the boundaries of art, the art conversation, the table seems to be set in the north. And sometimes people from outside of the North are included, but mostly we're rather a distant sight beyond that immediate first circle. And I want to reverse that a little bit and talk about the kinds of conversations that are happening at many tables. And the first artist I want to talk about is named Zanele Moholi. And mostly I know Zanele's work by her being a very intimate partner of mine in terms of my own collaborative work. I've interviewed her, I've eaten with her, I've looked at her work, I've discussed her work. I've only actually once gone to a gallery in which her work was exhibited. And that was in New York last year, in which my experience was a little bit like this. The work consists of 260 portrait images, some of which I will share with you. But I want to tell you about the experience that is about walking into a space that has been shaped by the presence of art as curated and hung, and in itself forming the work, the walls of the space that you're entering, right? Which is very different from seeing it on a little iPad or the other screens that I'd become used to. I'd seen them in books as well. So that, the verticality and the three-dimensionality, the concreteness and solidity of the experience of going into a space that is shaped by art is part of what I want to speak about. And that happens not only in the room, right? So let me tell you what it was like to enter that space. I want to read some pieces because I actually just recently contributed this to a new catalogue of Zanele Moholi's art, so I had to think very carefully about how to describe that experience. And so here is that particular encounter. In May 2013, I visited an exhibition of Zanele Moholi's photographic series, Faces and Phases, in a New York gallery. So now I'm going to be touching your little screen.
This one?
Not yet.
We can pass it around to you. I'm happy to do that.
Indeed. So it starts here and it goes to the end of the series. And looking at the multiplicity of them is part of what I'd like you to experience. I had seen the black and white portraits of transgender men and lesbian women on screen and in books, but this was the first time I stood in front of the photographs and looked into the eyes of the people inside them. The soaring amplitude of a converted factory provided a stark white background to the images arranged at eye level in two linked square rooms. I walked slowly along the gallery's walls and angles until I had looked at every face, lingered before every photograph. As I stood in front of them and moved between them, they did not seem simply to offer themselves to be looked at. Instead, they appeared as intent on me as I was on them, returning my gaze with expressions ranging from authoritative to wary to thoughtful to undefended, inviting me to turn my body to them in particular ways. I found that the portraits both asserted the weight of a counter-archive and reflected an awareness of identity's multiplicity and flux. As I paused and observed, the voluminous space filled with intimacy and questions, an insistent mutuality. The curation of the photographs invited me into an intensely reciprocal encounter. Both the photographs and the articulated space of the gallery, this is something that we see here, right? The walls articulated with one another, spaces articulating with one another, our bodies articulating with the walls and with one another. Both the photographs and the articulated space of the gallery created a mutual intentness between the images and the viewer. The architectural contrast of intimacy and scale, nearness and interval, was matched by the play between the linear arrangement of images and the movement of the body and the gaze around corners, of individual photographs and the spaces between them. The square rooms with their hinged corners meant I experienced not only the regular pulse of portrait after portrait, but also its interruption and reconfiguration. I think especially in an era where so much of our lives come to us so easily and apparently with such immediacy on the screen, really to take the bus or the subway or here, walk to the gallery, pay the admission fee or make your way past the guard, up the stairs into the particular gallery that you need to go to. That is a physical experience of approach that I think is utterly crucial for grasping part of what art wants of us, right? So in my view, art is not only what is given to us, art is also what wants and desires something from us. And in my view, what feminist art does is desire particular things from us. It nudges and demands and shifts us in ways that I think more normative art does not. And I think the idea of a dinner table that is set for people who are not there, and a dinner table that is set for people who have not been invited to other tables, asks us where our bodies belong, right? Asks us who has been invited, and also asks who has done the inviting. And so this is another way in which I, from the South, think about the idea of inclusion and exclusion and boundaries in the art world. Now, I said that I wanted to start with Zanele Moholi because on visiting this exhibition myself, it struck me that that was one way in which the art that I'm intimate with resonated very directly with the curation of these works and this gallery. And now I want to speak with you about other works, including some of the artists who are included in that book that so famously came out of the Brooklyn exhibition on global feminisms, right? The catalog and the book that accompanied the opening of the Sackler Gallery, and which in some ways has become a canonical and important work of art. In that book, there were essays that did actually address the question that I'm posing, which is where are the boundaries of the transnational art world? Because they spoke about African artists as well, including an artist who is another one of South Africa's artists who I've worked on, again, intimately and critically. And this artist is Bernie Searle. And once we go around the room entirely, I'll pull up her work as well. I mention her because, I'll quote to you a very well-known gallerist in South Africa called Michael Stevenson, who has two galleries in the major art cities in South Africa, which are Johannesburg and Cape Town. So Michael Stevenson is in Cape Town, the gallery, and then there's the Stevenson Johannesburg gallery as well. And I've interviewed Michael. He represents Lanele Moholi as well as Bernie Searle. And it struck me, of course, that both of these artists, Moholi, for instance, was in Documenta as well as in the Venice Biennale. She's a really profoundly well-known artist. But so is Bernie Searle. And then I started to count the other artists whom I'm also that I also included in the images in that collection. And I said, these are quite a lot of South African artists who I thought of as having an international profile. Michael said, it's actually ridiculous. South Africa is way overrepresented. Relative to the proportion of people, South Africa has far too many internationally known artists. And one has to ask why. Obviously, it's because they're superb artists. But I think also because but also because they resonate with certain questions and because they are legible to an international art market, right? So all of these factors, I think, need to be part of our understanding of why it is that certain people are around the table and others are not, why it is that certain people are in MoMA, others are not, why it is that certain people become recognizably part of their country's international arts profile. William Kentridge, David Goldblatt, these are names that those of you who know transnational art, curators know, right? So South Africa is legible in certain ways. And then also, I think there are certain ways in which its legibility appears to come too quickly. And I want to interrupt a little and speak a little bit about what I think are some of the conversations that are less heard in South African transnational art. So I'll speak a little bit about Bernie Searle next, and also the work that she draws on, which refers to a very famous figure that I will allude to in a moment. Okay, so my own history of looking at art is a complicated one. I'm in my mid-40s now, and when I was 25, it was the very first time in my life that I voted. Right? Why was this? Not because I didn't bother to get up on election day and go and vote before that, but because it was the first time that black people were allowed to vote in South Africa in 1994. Now, that is one measure of participation in a national life. But there are other measures as well. One of which is, who is included in the National Art Gallery of South Africa? In the days I was growing up, there were no black artists in the gallery. In fact, most of our art, especially the venerated art, was European art, some American pieces. And of course, many of them will probably be replicated in the permanent collections of many museums, right? The great European painters. If you have a minor Manet or something, that's the thing that you show to everybody, that testifies to the fact that your gallery is made in, right? So when I was growing up, I never went to art galleries. I actually didn't know what it meant to stand in front of a piece of art and feel a reciprocity with it, right? When I read about gallery openings and how people would have a glass of wine and stand and speak with one another in muted voices and look very elegant, that was a foreign country to me. I didn't know the language, I didn't know the culture, I felt utterly excluded from it. So when I entered the galleries around the mid-1990s, I had to learn what it meant to be hailed by a painting, by an artwork, and feel that I belonged there, that it spoke to me. That it wasn't only speaking to the elegant people who knew what to say while they held a glass of wine in their hands. I want to speak to you about the artworks that I encountered when I first entered those galleries. So here is a work by Tracy Rose that I'm going to
ask us to just show very briefly.
Has everybody seen?
As soon as you're done, I'll call up the Tracy Rose image. So the image I'm going to ask us to look at, I'll hold it up briefly and then it'll go around. Because it's got that instant legibility that I want us to think about. In the South African National Gallery, and this is in Cape Town, those of you who go to South Africa, I really highly recommend going as a lover of art. Right? Thank you. Okay, so Tracy Rose. This is the image. It's called The Kiss. Right? It's one of the first works that you'll see upon, now you can look at it more closely. One of the first works you'll see on entering this building, which is one of the oldest buildings in Cape Town, and hence one of the oldest buildings in South Africa, because Cape Town was the first colonial city in South Africa. So that's a large photographic work, right? In the South African National Gallery, I am drawn to Tracy Rose's The Kiss. Standing before it, I become a self who trembles with a slow ecstasy at this work. Sounds a bit slightly, do I really? But, you know, you allow yourself to feel and to express your feelings in front of art, right? I feel an elastic, mobile desire for the man and the woman in it, the intimacy of their blissful grasp, and the difference that the black and white photograph gives to his skin and her skin. Facing the photograph and its questions, I find that the work teaches me how to look at it, leading my gaze to instant, visceral recognition and all of its pleasures. Then, something about the image, perhaps the very ease of understanding it, nudges me towards a slight hesitance. And then open fracture, when the solidity of the difference between them dissolves, i.e. facing the difference between his skin and her skin. Facing the puzzle of a photograph, the entwined, juxtaposed bodies present a teething, fluttering enigma. I cast about for a new framework. Into this unsettling openness, a new kind of recognition comes to me. The difference between their bodies is false, after all, because both are black. The recognition of my initial instantaneous gratification, and then the hesitance, and then the new recognition, holds a new enchantment. One that nonetheless retains within it the memory of my misperception, a questioning of my eye. In its pleasures, the photograph trains me to recognize where to find pleasure, how to grasp it, and yet to have an eye that is always learning. So in South Africa, people like me would have been called colored by apartheid. But people who are called colored undermine the idea of racial classification, because coloredness had boundaries where it was black and boundaries where it looked white. And in response to the fiction of racial classification, people like me refused the word colored, and we identified ourselves as black, only black, either white or black. So in that photograph, Tracy Rose, who's a very well-known black artist, is playing with what appears to be a perfectly obvious answer to a perfectly ordinary question. Are you white or are you black? And she plays, and the photograph plays, and part of the ecstasy is that play with that immediate legibility, right? And the way that art invites and then refuses legibility. So Tracy Rose's The Kiss.
What other images do we see in the South African National Gallery? A second one, this time in the University of Cape Town, actually, in the library. It's a very famous and contentious artwork called
Sarah Bartman by Billy Bester. If you had somebody who was more able with technology, I'd have gotten it much quicker. But here is Bartman by Billy Bester, right? I'm going to send it around, of course.
This woman, Sarah Bartman, is one of the most famous icons of South African visual history. And she has been in much art, and much very damaging art. But this is something else entirely. So what does Bartman, what does Billy Bester do with Bartman? He sold those discarded metals into sculptures that retain the evidence of past abandonment. His sculpture of Bartman presents no rounded edges and no redemption. His vision of her operates in three planes. Her body, incarnated in metal, thrusts forward, but a chain on her right ankle, and both are made of the same material, her ankle and the chain, pulls her backward towards the past. Held above, her arms are in a stance of readiness, and her crowned face looks to the side, open-eyed and alert. The pressured lines and glinting, jagged textures of Bartman's figure present an intractable testament to the violence of the past that no good intentions can burnish away. But her eyes show an agile, thinking presence. And though in three planes, there is a coherence and power in the being that is conveyed in the sculpture. I think this idea of art's tenderness and its recognition of the fractures and jagged edges of the past, and its refusal to redeem that past, is part of what must happen when we're all invited into the gallery. Right? We can't find there something closed and complete and entirely reassuring. Right? So, I want to speak just briefly about a very beautiful and startling image before I come back to the portraits that I start with, and then perhaps we can have a set of discussions. The beautiful image I want to draw your attention to is one by Bernie Searle. This is a sculptor. In fact, she's now returned to teaching sculpture at the University of Cape Town. When I knew her, she was, at that time, a lecturer in sculpture, but then she left to become a full-time artist. She's attained, you know, extraordinary success. She was exhibited in MoMA. See how I'm using MoMA as a measure of success? She's now back at lecturing. Surely that, too, must be a success, right, to have a faculty job at a well-known university. The work that I'm referring to was one of her earlier works, before she really attained the prominence that she had later. It's from a 1999 work called Color Me, which consisted of a range of photographs installed in a commercial gallery. And in front of the photographs were little bottles filled with spice, as well as spice piled on the floor. Now, those of you who buy cinnamon, saffron, you know that piles of spice piled on the floor is hundreds of dollars piled on the floor, right? You put them in small bottles because they're that precious. Spice used to mean money, right? Fortunes were made. Countries were conquered. Human beings were enslaved and murdered because of spice, right? So
So in the photograph of Bernie Searle that I'm going to show you in a moment, the beauty, the mesmerizing color, the preciousness, but also the violence of that history of spice are all present. And again, what she does is, this is Bernie Searle, she uses her own body, a body and its naked availability in this image, which refers to the way in which bodies such as hers were part of the damage, the detritus, the forgotten aftermath of the preciousness of spice. Right? And when you look at the image, which fortunately Dana has recalled much more quickly than I could have done. I know it was me. There we go. I'm trying not to touch it. So this is one of a series. It's called Untitled. And in other photographs, you see her body full length, naked, and covered with spice. And this is chili, others have black pepper, cinnamon, pea flour, etc. Painful, covered by these things. But again, alluding then to the intimacy of history, right? Spices today, of course, are in our kitchen. We taste them, we take them into our bodies, but they also have history. And this is the history that she forces us to look at again, right? Because she looks back from inside the history. So let me return again to the Moholy images and what is happening in this kind of arrangements of portraits that I was describing right at the beginning of my talk. Zanele Moholy, as I mentioned, recently represented South Africa at the Venice Biennale, and then before that at Documenta, which is one of those once every 5 years exhibitions that have an extraordinary level of visibility and prestige in the art world. Why was she included in that exhibition? Partly it's because she's a very well-trained photographer. She produces work of genuine emotional acuity and artistic accomplishment. But that's not what she says she does. What she says she does is that she's an activist first. So she's taken the very power, the possibility of crossing boundaries that all of you were speaking about at the beginning, the status, the visibility, and she's saying, I am going to change the world. I'm not going to make money, because in fact she has almost no money. She uses every cent that she earns as part of her activist work. And her activist work is to end the homophobia and the violence that trans people and lesbians face in South Africa. Right? And what she's realized is that making art is how to change the world. Right? So that collection of photographs that I saw in New York was also the collection of photographs in Documenta and the Biennale, the Venice Biennale. And it's in this new book of photographs that I mentioned a few minutes ago. So what is she doing, and what does she think that photographs can do to change the world? So she became known in 2004 in her first exhibition and book. The book was called Early Half of Picture. And what she did then, she was to reverse a double erasure. First of all, she was documenting the women who were subjected to extraordinary levels and extent of violence. In other words, many women were being subjected to violence, but also the level of violence was spectacular and extraordinary. These were women who were lesbian and often living in poor communities. But more than that, they were being stigmatized for being violated, and they were being ignored and neglected by the criminal justice system. And because of the fear of violence, not only was the violence they were experiencing neglected and invisible, but
the fear of violence was also erasing them from public space. Right? So this double erasure, forcing people to go back in the closet, as one of her partners in her project has called it, was something that she was contesting. So she, in her first book, produced what she called very angry photographs, photographs that refused to accept erasure. And she did change the world, actually. Now South Africa has been forced to face this legacy of homophobia and transphobia. There are increasing numbers of prosecutions as well as actual convictions. So that is one change. But Moholi also moved on from what she called angry reportage, right? And in her next series of work, she drew on performance, but she also drew on sexual pleasure, intimacy, eroticism, to shift the way in which one could claim once again to be visible if you're a lesbian and poor and black, if you're a trans person and poor and black. So she tried to generate a new language for speaking about eroticism and love and beauty and intimacy. And here's the place where I want to again ask to retain the critical lens, because I'm not sure that that's a successful language that she created, right? She's somebody I adore and admire and want to emulate, but I can also speak of where I think she has not entirely achieved what she has intended to. And I think this must also be the case of all the people whom we appreciate and adore and admire, right? If we're critics, then they are artists. And then the next work that she started in 2006 and is ongoing is called Faces and Phases, P-H-A-S-E-S, the second word. So Faces and Phases were the portraits that you looked at first. And you'll see there, I think, a whole range of images and expressions, and I think these leave us with a certain question, and I would love then to ask that question with you. What is it that we see when we see those faces, right? What is it, what is the language, and what is the invitation she's issuing to us by lining up faces, some of them extreme close-ups from here above, and they're all about double the size of these frames here. Some of them from the waist upwards.
So, Batesta Segali is one from Gaborone. She's from Botswana. Sorry, he is from Botswana.
So, part of what I want to call attention to is that these are not images of people in trauma. They are people who comport their bodies in ways in which they want to present themselves to our gaze, right? They know that a meeting is taking place, and they're deciding how they will turn, what they're wearing, what their expression is, and exactly what their reciprocal relationship will be with the viewer. Ties, especially by the trans men, whom she says, I see them like Obama. You know, they're politicians, they're leading the fight for us of recognition. And trans women who, in their hair, their dresses, are presenting themselves in ways that play with visibility. Right? This tie, worn again by Batesta Segali, is unknotted, it's folded, it's a gesture tie, it's a nominal tie, it ends about here. I love the thought that there's a space here, there's a conversation here that is happening, which makes me think about what I'm wearing when I'm watching these images, right? Something is in play. Something is happening that is deeply mutual. And that, to me, is a change in the world. Because neither of us are static, neither the person in the image nor I as the viewer. And something about that reciprocal relationship between us is making a different world. So that's what I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I look forward very much to hearing your questions and what you think of this particular part of the conversation around the table. Shall I sit down?
You should do whatever makes you feel comfortable.
I'm going to stand so you can see me, and if you have any questions or comments.
I thought it was really significant what you said about how the photos don't represent trauma at all, because there's a really, especially in the United States, there's a narrative associated with trans people that is all about, there's a focus on the transition and how painful it is and how inspirational it is that they get through that. And it's much more humanizing to just see them as people presenting themselves the way they want to, instead of focusing on that pain, because that really dehumanizes trans people.
I agree completely. I think that's very much the motivation there, that there is a space allowed for people if they're traumatized, if they accept that they're going to die or are suicidal, or, you know, that we know that as well from earlier incarnations of who was just allowed into public space, like the tragic mulatto figure from around the turn of the 20th century, the tragic gay figure, now it's the tragic trans figure. And we don't have to engage with that, right? So yes, I agree completely.
So you mentioned that you were going to talk a little bit about how the places where you feel like maybe she's not as successful. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yes, well, I can show you an image where I'm going to quote Andile Mtsitane, a South African critic and politician, actually, now. You know that we're about to elect our new parliament on May the 7th. And he said, all right, so tell me, how is this image different from a cosmopolitan image? An image in Cosmopolitan magazine. I wouldn't go so far, but I would say, what is the available language of eroticism and intimacy? And I don't know the answer to that question, but does it involve black satin sheets and lace? Right? And that is a difficult question, right? This is somebody who's really deeply thought about this, and I don't know what to say. And I think she is working out what she's saying. And these are not the only images. This series, by the way, is very famous or infamous. It's called the Being series, B-E-I-N-G, B-E-I-N-G. Zanele Moholy visited Penn State in March 2010. When she was here on March 1st, 2010, a huge controversy broke out. She had to be on the line, on the telephone to international journalists and South African journalists. Why? Because it was revealed on that day, something that had happened some months before, on the 9th of August, 2009, which is that the Minister of Arts and Culture in South Africa, you don't have a Secretary of Arts here in the US, which I think, by the way, is scandalous. But there is actually a ministry devoted to funding and promoting the arts. And the minister, Ms. Lou Zingwana, had provided the funding for an exhibition of the work of 10 women artists. She had gone to the exhibition opening, had seen photographs by Moholy, as well as another artist, a Swazi artist named Nandipa Mutambo, spectacular, by the way. Looked at them, spun on a leg, left, and refused to open the exhibition. He said, these are immoral, offensive, and against nation building. So her own department, which had funded this exhibition.
Which is the opposite of what art's supposed to be.
Precise.
Yeah.
If art is nation building, we have to think again about it. She thought it was pornographic, she thought it was not suitable for children to watch. She was using all of this really old-fashioned language of homophobia and censorship, right? Which was very anxiety-provoking. And of course it generated necessarily a very vigorous response from the arts community and from people who love their own freedom of mind. And the department as well as the minister stepped back from those remarks, right? But
as I think relatively innocuous and unradical as these images are,
they're still crossing the lines that official culture finds threatening, right? So I celebrate this image, even as I continue to wonder, what is a language of lesbian eroticism? What is a language of trans intimacy? You artists and curators and lovers of art might have a good answer for that.
Oh yeah,
absolutely. Eroticism coming up. any other questions? Yeah.
I would find a little issue on the Ministry of Art being scandalous. In this country, they don't want the Soviet model of the Ministry of Culture. We want art to be free. And the Ministry of Art go towards American realism or something like that, which would be terrible. So that's the thing, you know, we want to be open, not boxed in by what some government tells us is good art or bad art. Or Pussy Riot has a concert here and has performance art. We don't want somebody whipping them and throwing them in jail because the government doesn't approve.
I agree with you, but I will tell you that the absence of funding for the art counts as much as a whipping. If you can't live from your art, there's no recognition for your art, you have to please the big gallerists, you have to sell your art, that is as much an oppression as government censorship. And of course, you can have a government department that is not a censoring department. You can have a government department that is held accountable by the community of artists. And that is what happened in the South African case. I do agree with you. But, you know, in the same way that you have a department of education, you have a department of health, all of these could be troubling, censoring, bureaucratic and ineffective departments, but you hold them to account, right? And I think that your money as American taxpayers should go into the arts as much as it goes into other crucial areas of culture without submitting to the threat of somehow confining oneself to art that the government will approve of. Give us the money and allow us to disseminate it in ways that are designed by artists themselves. That's what I would call.
It's troubling that in 2009 we kind of have that same critique of pornographic work that exactly the same in the 1980s is when that was said about this work here. That was, you know, the big thing that these are pornographic of seeing.
Yeah, it's an available critique, right?
Yeah. It's like a comment that is so odd that continues to be this work.
Yeah.
And with our National Gallery for the Arts, you know, it's like the same, you know, it's sort of oversight of what is funded or not. And so there's, you know, the kind of combinations and, you know, which funder you're talking about, how it's funded and who oversees it, who makes the decision about, you know, what gets funded.
Precisely, yeah. You know, it depends on how fragile the culture of discussion is, the conversation is, right? If Penn State could be criticized for having a pornographic artist in its collection, wasting its money, and, you know, its funding from the state threatened, that is a very problematic culture of art and of politics. I think we should take it on. The fact that pornography can be used as such an easy weapon is a scandal, right? And it's our job to resist the easiness of that.
Luckily, we have people here and in other places who can argue that
the culture wars. Well, the, what did the representative say? I don't know. I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it. Luckily, we have people like you and other people in this room who can argue that what pornography is worth. So.
Yeah. And how you have to learn how to see.
I think it's really interesting, like in a discussion of international and transnational art, when you mentioned using MoMA as a measure of success, because we really tend to, when it comes to artists outside of this country, we will say, like, they're the, you know, African, whoever, American or European artist, and it's really kind of like, that's how we sell artists in this country, like from outside of this country. We say, like, well, they're just like this artist that you probably are already familiar with, mm-hmm. and it creates that familiarity, that comfort, so that we're not like, oh, is this too foreign? Is this too different? Mm-hmm. And it happens all the time.
I agree, yeah. And that's also something that we need to think about, right? That our currency of prestige and visibility is profoundly unequal. To exactly what difference and innovation should be what we're interested in. But as long as we can translate it and convert it either into money or visibility in the ways that we know, a gallery in Chelsea or Los Angeles or New York. Or, I know Chelsea was in New York. It's almost a different
country. Could be London.
Yeah, that's true.
Also, I think that goes back to your comment about national nation building. Mm-hmm. You know, after World War II, New York was the art capital of the world. Mm-hmm. And now you have significant people in Hong Kong, Abu Dhabi, London. You know, New York is not the capital of the art world anymore. So when you do recognize those things, if you don't other, then you are perhaps admitting some culpability in the loss of that prestige.
Mm-hmm.
Or participation.
The other hand, Abu Dhabi, Hong Kong, Singapore, New York, Dakar, Johannesburg, the same curators tend to circle, the same publishers, even the same artists. So, you know, it's an ongoing, it's a process. Fortunately, it's a dynamic process, and there are ways in which we can make it more radical than it is.
It's 1 o'clock, and I know that the students in the class, you need to leave, and I want to thank you again for bringing this perspective.